a very special interview segment on the advanced cardiac guidelines and cardiac care guidelines just recently released by the American Heart Association. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I don't want to take too long here in the intro because we've got a big section coming up. A great interview segment I was able to set up with the American Heart Association with the incoming chair of the Emergency Cardiovascular Care Committee at the American Heart Association, Dr. Monica Kleinman. She was talking about the new ECC 2010 guidelines that have just been released last week. So I know you may have seen some other things about this, but I think you may not have had an opportunity, as I did, to sit down and talk with Dr. Monica Kleinman. So that'll be coming up later on in this episode. Another guest on the episode to help me out with the questions was Tom Boothalay. So some of you who are maybe involved in the emergency care setting may know Tom as the author and running person, I guess the authority over at the 12-lead pre-hospital 12-lead blog. And Tom is a great resource for reading EKGs and also for understanding 12-lead technology and its applications. And so even if you are not in the pre-hospital field, I would urge you, if you want a primer course on cardiology, check out the information available at his blog. A lot of great information there. Tom's a paramedic and educator down in Hilton Head, South Carolina, and he was on the show as well to help me ask some important questions of Dr. Kleinman about the research and understanding the reasons for the changes in the upcoming or the recently released guidelines from the American Heart Association. Don't forget you can find links to Tom's blog as well as the cardiology updates and ECC 2010 updates available over at nursingshow.com in the show notes for this episode. Don't forget you can also get back in touch with me if you have any questions, if you need any additional information or just want to hook up with Dr. Kleinman or perhaps with Tom. I will be happy to forward any emails you send me. Just send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com and we will get that information out to you and respond to you. I return every email I get, so don't hesitate to shoot me an email. I love to hear from the listeners and viewers here at The Nursing Show. Don't forget also, you can find a lot of other great nursing and other healthcare-related programs over at promednetwork.com. And that is the home of The Nursing Show as a primary location for great healthcare programming, and I think you'll be happy with any of the shows you might find over there. That's it. We're going to jump in here in just a sec into the interview with Dr. Monica Kleinman from the American Heart Association and my assistant interviewer, who's probably took the bulk of the questions off my hands and asked some really good ones, Tom Boothalay from the Pre-Hospital 12-Lead blog. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am very excited. You know, the 2010 guidelines for cardiac care have just come out, and I was able to bring on two great medical professionals that have a lot of background in experience and education in cardiac care. First off, Dr. Monica Kleinman, who is the incoming chair of the Emergency Cardiovascular Care Committee at the American Heart Association and with the and one of the co-authors of the 2010 guidelines. Dr. Kleinman, thank you so much for coming on and talking with the listeners about some of the new updates.
It's my pleasure.
And I also have Tom Boothalay, who is, well, many of us probably know him as the author of the pre-hospital 12-lead blog, but Tom is also a lieutenant paramedic at Hilton Head. I'm going to let you actually say it, Tom, because it's a mouthful.
Hilton Head Fire and Rescue.
See, I could have just said two more words. I would have been done.
Yeah, that wasn't so bad, was it?
No, it wasn't so bad. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing well, and I certainly wouldn't put myself in the same league as Dr. Kleinman, but I too am very excited to have this conversation with her. I know this is a very exciting time for everyone that is passionate about emergency cardiac care.
So, Dr. Kleinman, just looking over the guidelines, I mean, they've only been out for 12 hours or so. The thing that caught me by surprise, I think, was that there don't seem to be just these major sweeping changes that I think a lot of people were thinking might happen based on what happened in 2005. Really, it seems to me more of a clarification of the 2005 guidelines.
Well, we are happy to see that there's a lot of evidence that supports the changes that we made in 2005. So that certainly is, it's gratifying when you find that the recommendations that you have made before get reinforced. There are a few things, though, I think that have changed, not as sweeping, as you point out, as we might have seen. You know, I think of the year 2000 guidelines as being the year of defibrillation, where early defibrillation was really the theme and the message that we tried to get forth. And in 2005, it was about basic life support. It was about the importance of high-quality CPR and getting back to basics, that it really mattered how well you did CPR in terms of the patient's overall outcome. This particular time around, we do have one important change for rescuers who are doing basic life support, and that is the change to the CAB sequence of steps. But we don't have quite the magnitude of emphasis on something really different.
Now, I know, Tom, you're going to want to jump into some of the advanced care changes, and I am interested in that as well as a paramedic and a nurse, but I think it's important to continue to focus on the basics, which I think the 2010 guidelines continue that focus from 2005, Dr. Klein, and really the focus on high-quality compressions and that refocusing to CAB. Did you see in the research that there still wasn't the continued focus on compressions as you looked around the world at the different systems implementing the 2005 guidelines, that there was a necessity to continue to go in that direction?
Certainly, it's something that I think for a long time, even though CPR has been around for 50 years, people have looked at as a not very sophisticated way of providing resuscitation care. But it turns out to be essential if any of the advanced techniques are going to be helpful. So, yes, we certainly do see a continued need to emphasize basic life support as a key component of any resuscitation. On the other hand, I do think we've seen improvements in outcome, and that's the most gratifying thing, which is that it does appear that we are making progress in the performance of CPR, the quality of CPR, that's leading to better outcomes for patients.
Tom, I know that you've, as an educator in your system, as an officer in your system, a part of what we do as educators and as paramedics is oversee the code process in the field, and that includes managing good BLS care. Do you see this as going to have any major change on working with your people in the field?
Well, I would say that in my organization over the past year, we've made tremendous strides. And in reading the 2010 guidelines, I noticed that it emphasizes the importance of quality measurement and benchmarking using registries like the CARES registry, the Cardiac Arrest Registry, to enhance survival. Dr. Klein, how important is it for each community to know its numbers?
That's been the topic of discussion, which is how are people going to be able to measure their own performance, monitor it, make interventions, and determine that they are constantly improving. Certainly, as a citizen, a layperson, or healthcare provider, in our own communities, if we are going to have a cardiac arrest ourselves, or if someone we love or a family member is going to have a cardiac arrest, I think it would certainly be important to know how well our community is ready to respond. And as healthcare educators, to want to do something to make a difference in the place that we live. And so this concept that a community would monitor its own performance as well as its own ability to be prepared for this rather large public health problem, I think is extremely important. And I hope that is going to be one of the things that catches on from this set of guidelines, that communities are need to feel empowered to take control of how they approach this from a public health perspective and what they do to educate their population and to prepare their system is important.
Well, I agree with that 100%. I think when we set about the process of trying to improve our approach to cardiac arrest patients, the very first thing we did was make contact with the CARES Registry, because going forward, we wanted to know how many out-of-hospital cardiac arrests happen in our community, and how many times is it witnessed by a bystander, and how often is CPR performed, how often is an AED used? What is our call received to first shock interval? So I think if you don't know those things, you can't possibly strengthen the chain of survival in your community if you don't understand it or if you don't know anything about it. So at least in my opinion, and I think this is validated by the 2010 guidelines, and it sounds like you agree, Doctor, then that's almost has to be the first step.
Yes, I think in any effort to ensure that a community is performing optimally with regard to its emergency care and its response to public safety, you have to be able to measure what you're doing. It's not something that we've traditionally done for emergency cardiac care. We may do it for water quality. We may do it for various other measures of police activity, but we've not looked at the emergency response to cardiac arrest in our community as a measure that should be focused upon. And I hope that this will start the process of getting communities excited about how they can get involved and make a difference.
Well, I also noticed, because Tom, you brought up the chain of survival. Hey, we've got a fifth link to the chain, which was I guess you could consider that a change. And I think it goes hand in hand with measurement, because we might get a return of spontaneous circulation in a patient, but if they don't walk out of the hospital at the other end, then they didn't get that important post cardiac arrest care that might have been necessary to continue that patient's steps towards recovery. And I was interested to see that you'd added that the ECC guidelines added another link to that chain of survival.
Yeah, that was a topic of great discussion, as you may imagine. The chain of survival has, really been an icon that we have looked to help us organize our systems and really look at the important components. But you can't ignore the fact that post-resuscitation care is just so important. We need the folks in the community, from the bystanders to the EMS agencies, to be able to get these patients to either a return of circulation or a point where they can have return of circulation. But what happens then at the hospital end is so crucial, because the regionalization of care and the development of stroke centers and trauma centers has shown us that by having an organized system of response to particular problems and focusing on those problems, you can make a difference in outcome. The same appears to be true for cardiac arrest. There's a group of professionals who think that cardiac arrest centers, that particular designation, like we have stroke centers, is the next step in trying to formalize this concept that having a package of care that you deliver to the post-cardiac arrest survivor can really make a difference in whether or not they do actually walk out of the hospital. And that is, of course, what we're all striving for.
Dr. Kleinman, how solid is the evidence that post-cardiac arrest patients in a persistent comatose state should be cooled?
I think it's very solid. We started with two very good studies in the first part of this past decade, looking at patients with witnessed arrest with ventricular fibrillation as their initial rhythm, and showed significant improvement in outcome. And the data that has continued to accumulate for patients with other initial rhythms or with other circumstances, even unwitnessed types of arrests, is really impressive. I think it really is a whole new world when you look at outcomes for patients who have return of circulation, and many of the things that we've previously believed dogmatically about prognosis have gone out the window. We need to look at this fresh.
Does that mean the previous dogma about downtimes greater than 10 minutes leading to irreversible brain death may not be true in the era of hypothermia?
I think that's the one area in which we can't be certain we're going to be able to make a difference. There probably is a point of no return. But whether it's 10 minutes or not, I think is really up in the air. And we need to keep our minds open until we push that envelope and see what hypothermia can do for the cardiac arrest survivor. I think we have to challenge all of our assumptions, including that one. But there probably will at some point be a point of no return. I just don't know where that will be.
Gotcha. Now, we've taken it all the way to post-cardiac arrest care. Can we backtrack a minute and go back
sure.
to... Okay. So one of the main surprises I had last night looking over the guidelines was that the ratio of 30 to 2 for the compression to ventilation ratio did not change. Surely there was a camp at the ILCOR conference that wanted to omit ventilations altogether. Could you comment on that?
Yes, and this is one of the most exciting things about this process, is that it is open, it is transparent. People who feel passionately about what the science shows and what their own experience has been have an opportunity to present that. And the debates that go on are very interesting. It's wonderful to have been a part of that. There certainly is a camp that would like to eliminate ventilations, or perhaps look at a modified way of doing ventilations, meaning providing some sort of passive oxygenation by oxygen delivery or airway pressure devices that don't require interruption of chest compressions in order to administer ventilations. And there's really interesting animal data, as well as some human studies that have looked at that particular technique and shown really no difference in outcome. The thing that is hard to do is to make a major change like that without having solid enough evidence that it is superior to what we are doing now. In other words, the fact that there may be a technique that's just as good is encouraging and is something that we need to consider. But the changes to the guidelines need to be made on evidence that shows here is a better way to do things. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, while we are excited about the possibility that not ventilating a patient may ultimately lead to better outcomes, we could not stand on that as a fact at this point. What we do know is that there are some important considerations with regard to education, with regard to adult learning, that make it appealing to use that approach for untrained rescuers or bystanders who may be called upon to react with minimal or no training. And we do know that it is more likely that you can coach a person to do chest compression only CPR than to do chest compression plus ventilation CPR. And so for that type of provider, it makes a tremendous amount of sense to use that technique. For the trained healthcare provider, until we have evidence that outcomes are actually better, we're going to continue to use the technique of 30 to 2 and use both ventilations and chest compressions.
You know, one interesting thing that struck me while reading the new guidelines is a new term, or at least a new term for me, was introduced, and that was the choreographed model in distinction to the sequence model. And it to me, it suggested that perhaps this is a false dilemma that we need to choose between ventilating a patient and doing chest compressions. Could you talk about that?
Yes, and not so much the fact, I think, that we need to choose to do one or the other, but the concept that things happen in order as opposed to simultaneously is one that we need to look at. So that one might be applying defibrillator pads while establishing vascular access, while preparing for an advanced airway, and that these things don't have to necessarily happen across a fixed timeline. This was, I think, a really interesting idea for us to think about for in-hospital resuscitation, because that's the situation in which you do tend to have more resources and the ability to perform actions simultaneously rather than in a preset order. That being said, I think the integration of compressions and ventilations isn't something that necessarily is going to change whether or not you have 10 people available or 2 people available. Because of the fact that you need to interpose them in a patient who isn't intubated. So it's more of a concept that looks at that team approach in the inpatient environment as opposed to the pre-hospital environment where you tend to have many fewer resources.
Yeah, well, as you know, the pre-hospital environment is tremendously variable in the United
That's
States
true.
Of America. So there are many, many places, like, for example, Wake County EMS in North Carolina comes to mind, where the resources may be at the scene to where the airway could be captured, say, with a supraglottic airway without interrupting the chest compressions, mm-hmm. and then asynchronous ventilations delivered, according to the 2010 guidelines, at 6 to 8 times. Every 6 to 8 seconds. I think a lot of professional rescuers would be surprised if they sat there with a stopwatch how slow that actually is. Dr. Kleinman, have we been hyperventilating our cardiac arrest patients, and why is that a problem?
We have been. I think that's a fact that we can't ignore. This really came to light in some important studies that were done in the animal lab, and then by folks who brought that to the field to do observations of how we were actually practicing. And it's not surprising that in a cardiac arrest, you've got people who are responding to an emergency, have their own adrenaline pumping, and are likely to do things in a more exaggerated and vigorous way. That may be good for chest compressions, but it's not good for ventilation because the practice of hyperventilating patients turns out actually interferes with the blood flow to the heart and may result in a decreased return of circulation. When they looked at pre-hospital care providers and simply observed what they were doing, they were hyperventilating. When they looked at healthcare providers in the inpatient setting, they were hyperventilating patients. And part of it came from our dogma that ventilations were good, that in cardiac arrest, those patients were not breathing well, and therefore hyperventilating them made sense. And people had to consciously think about slowing down in a way that they'd never had done before. I think it was really challenging for people at the bedside to remember, I need to slow down. But it is something that needs to be remeasured and looked at, because I don't think we have a good sense as to how well that recommendation is actually being carried out at this point. And we need to consistently reinforce this with our teams, that one of the things to look at is that the person at the airway needs to be aware of their rate of ventilations and ensure that they're not hyperventilating.
The 2005 guidelines talked about the importance of providing chest compressions after the shock, at least for a minute or so, so that the post-shock rhythm had time to organize. The 2010 guidelines talk about minimizing the interval between the last compression and providing the shock. How important is that? And can rescuers or first responders perform chest compressions while the AED is charging, or will that confound the computerized analysis somehow?
So a couple of questions there. It is important to minimize the interruptions in compressions. When you look at this in animal models, it's very impressive how quickly coronary perfusion drops to a minimal amount, and the difference in your ability to resuscitate someone from cardiac arrest is remarkable when you've got interruptions in compressions compared to those who have much briefer interruptions. These interruptions are inevitable with the technology we have now, because right now we have not had technology that can allow us to do chest compressions through a defibrillation, for instance. And so our goal has to be to minimize them. So it is important on both ends to minimize the shock, chest compression to shock difference and the interval of stopping compressions before you shock. It is important to start compressions right away because the shock may have organized the rhythm but may not have resulted in a pulsatile state because the heart is distended and dysfunctional by the period of cardiac arrest. With regard to whether or not we can do chest compressions while the AED is charging, I think it's an excellent question that we'll have to work with industry to determine the impact of chest compressions on the analysis by the machines, to determine if there's any way we can chip away at the time it takes to analyze the rhythm. Because, of course, it's equally important that that be accurate and that shocks be delivered or not delivered, depending on an accurate analysis of the rhythm.
And that's going to wrap up part one of this segment. It was a nice long interview. We talked for about 45 minutes. So we'll pick up with part two of this interview on the new emergency cardiovascular care guidelines. And we'll be pushing into some of the advanced care changes in the advanced cardiac life support sector and some of the things that you as nurses and healthcare professionals in and out of hospitals might need to know about advancing changes in cardiac care over the coming year as these new 2010 guidelines are implemented. So stay tuned for that coming up in next week's episode of The Nursing Show. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank again Dr. Kleinman for coming on and having an opportunity to sit down with me and talk with myself and Tom Boothelet about the ECC 2010 update and guideline changes for cardiovascular care. I also want to remind you that you can follow up on links to Tom's excellent blog on ECGs and 12 leads over at the Nursing Show site, nursingshow.com. Just click the show notes link right at the top of the page, and you can go ahead and find the episodes listed down there. The most recent episode listed first and then in reverse chronological order, so you can just scroll down and find the episode you're looking for. I would also urge you to shoot me an email if you have any specific questions or just want to have a comment or offer suggestions for this or any other episode. Just send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. Also, don't forget the Nursing Show fan page over at Facebook, facebook.com/nursingshow. And of course, you can follow me directly over on Twitter and over on Facebook under the handle Podmedic. So twitter.com/podmedic or facebook.com/podmedic. That's it for me. I will be back very soon. You know, you may have noticed that I missed last Friday. Just too many conferences in a row to get another episode out. And I do apologize. I only miss maybe one or two weeks a year. This was one of them. So I will be going strong here through the end of the year, I promise. I will get wrapped up here on the show and remind all of you that we'll be back next week with another episode every single Friday. In the meantime, I want you to check out some music. I've got a song here by Johanna Staley. We've played her songs here on the show before. I don't think I've played this particular song, but I think it's a song that you might enjoy, so I thought I'd pull something out of the rest of her catalog, and you can check it out. If you like what you hear, you can find a link to her music in the show notes and also a link to check out her songs over in iTunes. If you like what you hear, you know, spend $1.29 or 99 cents, whatever it is, on a song. You know, for less than the cost of a soda, you can get a great great song, and you can also share and support independent music artists who share their songs with podcast listeners like you. And so without further ado, let's jump on into that song by Johanna Staley. I Don't Love You is the name of the song. I hope you enjoy it. So I want to remind all of you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
There you go. You only know what you wanna know, and my words fall through your ears and past your soul. Been sitting on my hands so long, trying to figure out just where I went wrong. Well, blame's a useless game, just trying to. Talking to you.